Hello there, and welcome to the Thank You Fellas podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt and Scott Keith. We are once again recording in person, which is a great feeling, great time to be able to do that again. You know, we had a pretty long break where we had to come up with episodes that were recorded by distance. That allowed us an opportunity to get some people on the show who we haven't had in a long time or that we've never had on the show because we just had to do Zoom calls in and we just made it work. But it's nice to be getting back to the usual formula a little bit. A couple weeks ago, Scott and I drove down to the old studio and we met with Rod and Adam and we recorded two episodes of normal Thank You Fellows down there. This week, Rod made it up to the mountains and he's sitting here in an office we've thrown together in Big Bear, and we're recording.
Thrown together. This is highly designed, my friend.
Yes, highly designed in Big Bear. And you know, I think we'll be making our way back down to the studio in the future.
Well, you're going
as well.
On vacation, so
I am going on vacation
because you just recently received a Master of Arts in Philosophical and Systematic Theology from the University of Nottingham.
Yes. Congratulations.
Yes, I just I actually woke up to the email this morning that was like, congratulations, graduate, would you like to join our alumni Facebook page? And I was like, no, I would not. Thank you.
I thought you said yes.
What was your thesis topic?
My thesis topic was on literary apologetics or the use of literature in doing theology.
Great topic.
Well, you should tell the story that so you did. You had come across some theses that were directed against using or implying theology on sort of literary schemes, and then you wrote. So I'll let you explain it.
So the theses that you're talking about, it's called the Seven Theses on Literature and Theology by the Mellon Working Group at the University of Notre Dame. Long title, but
makes them sound smart.
Makes them sound smart. many of the people who contributed to it are very smart, but the theses identify a problem, which is the coexistence or the collaboration between literature and religion departments in undergrad and through graduate work in university departments, and its identification is a problem of those two departments being able to get along and interact with each other in such a way that those two disciplines work together rather than against each other at the university.
And they want them to work against each other.
No, they want them to work together.
Oh, sorry.
They believe they have been put in a position where often they are in a tension that is not necessary.
Okay.
And so the issue that they're trying to... Now, the interesting thing about the theses is that they put the weight of the problems on the relationship between literature and theology on theology. That those who practice, the professors of religion and academic study of religion, imposes dogma onto literature that makes that relationship unbalanced and thus hard to engage in.
So a theology professor will read a work of literature that is secular in nature and say, hey, I see theological themes here.
Yeah.
And sort of impose it on those themes. And these
or use it to interpret them.
Yep. Or use it to interpret them. And they're saying this is...
And they're saying because of the nature of religious dogma and somebody having strict commitments to doctrine... that they're going to sort of impose those on literature where they might not actually be.
Oh gosh,
interesting.
Right, so the address. So the question is, what can be done to make them work together? Now, the theses after this, after the introduction, are primarily positive. They say something like, "Religion and literature should work together to further the inquiry into the human past, so that we might." Live peacefully together, or something like that. That's a very brief paraphrase. Or that the investigation of such should lead to understanding of people and religious groups and cultures outside of your own experience or
yeah.
stuff like this. And it's seven positive theses. Some of them good, some of them iffy, and then there's proofs in there. So what I did is I took those theses and that critique in the beginning, and I asked the question, is there a way for Christian theology and the way that Christian literary apologetics has been done to satisfy the base concerns of the theses without reducing Christian theology to just another, a hyper-contextualized literature? Because that's the obvious risk that happens in these theses when theology is the bad guy and the positive ends is always them working together. It errs on the side of theology's hyper-contextualized literature.
Got it.
And it's literature for a particular group of
right.
people.
Yep.
Right.
What do they call it? The officer in charge at a university? Diversity officer.
Yeah.
The diversity. Is what you're doing going to going to please our diversity officer or not?
Yep. So now, while I did have some critiques of the seven theses, I did pose a slight agreement with the idea that religion can't, or the use of literature apologetically can in fact be where the relationship is, that literature is always in service to theology. And so if you are teaching these side by side, this one will always trump. Whatever this one says is true, whatever this one says is allegorical. And that they identify that is a true risk of these two interacting. So the question is there a usefulness? Can we maintain that a religion has truth claims that aren't just types of literature, and that literature is still useful to those people with those truth claims, even if it has disagreements. Mm-hmm. And so my thesis basically said that we can use literature in a way that's catechetical without lording over it.
Yeah,
we don't have to make literature Christian in order to use it.
Yep.
For theology.
Yep.
And theological questions, conversely, can be important to the creation of literature, the interpretation of literature,
yep.
and the use of literature in a society which has theological, underpinnings.
Yeah. So what examples did you use?
I used one Christian example and one completely non-Christian example to try to make the point of catechetical. So I used C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce as an example of a Christian piece of literature that provides sort of a groundwork for how Christian dogmatic questions can show up in literature without that piece of literature being a systematic theology proper. Because right. Lewis sort of qualifies that at the beginning, that this is not the Christian doctrine of heaven and hell, but these doctrines worked out in pictures and
it's
theory.
A story of a dream.
Right. And then for the second piece, I used a TV show called The Boys, which I wrote about in a short blog last year and expanded on the idea of this. There's some debate as whether TV is literature or not. That I kind of talked about that debate briefly in the paper, but fell on the side that because TV, like plays and other visual arts, is written, is scripted, and then essentially out, that it is literary in its efforts. And the reason I chose The Boys is because not only is that show, like in its ethical presentation, very hard for Christians to swallow, but it is...
Well, the major portions of it are a representation of evangelical American theology.
And it is a complete rejection of it. It's atheistic in its nature. It's directly anti-Christian. It mocks American Christianity. It mocks God directly. Yeah. And so I use that as an example of something which can be theological without us saying Christianity has to beat it or has to form it into a Christian piece of a literature, because it's obviously not a Christian piece of literature.
Yeah. So what was your conclusion?
My conclusion is that sort of with Lewis and Tolkien, that there are universal themes in literature and that those have theological implications. So if you have a show or a book or something like The Boys that is setting out to be anti-Christian, it inherently has to deal with Christian theological topics. And it asks theological questions. You can't fight out against God without defining who God is. You can't fight against the idea of Christian hypocrisy like the show is without defining what Christian ethics are supposedly. If you're saying, oh, Christians are a bunch of hypocrites or something like that. So you actually have to engage with that material if you're going to be anti. As well, that those universal themes, like I used the theme of total depravity and the doctrine of sin.
In the boys. Oh yeah.
Right. So
even with superheroes.
Where this is the show questions authority, questions power. It affirms the idea that power corrupts. These are all truths that the Christian can affirm. And these are all things that literature can actually teach us in a visual or even in an imaginative way. So that we can say, what does that actually look like? So we can say axioms like power corrupts, or that all people are corrupted, and that those with power have opportunity to exercise that corruption. This actually gives you a frame of reference to imagine what that looks like and imagine what that is in your own heart. Yeah. And that it's not an improper use of theology to, once somebody is struck with this dilemma, struck with the dilemma of total depravity, their own contribution to that depravity. And one of the unique things about The Boys is that the true good guys in the show
are bad guys.
Are also bad. They're horrible. Like, they, in order to achieve good, they do horrible things. And so you kind of realize that there's just no good guys. Right? There's bad and sort of better.
Which is funny that, 'cause that is, I mean, strictly speaking, saying that all people are born sinful and unclean is accurate, but it also doesn't account for the fact that these sinful people can do good things.
Right.
Especially what we call sort of in the left-hand kingdom, right? In the, on the secular side of things. That show itself is interesting because there is no good in it. And I recall sometimes when we talk about this with Rod, you know, remembering statements about how nice it was when he was younger that there were actually good guys on TV and stuff like that, and how sort of sometimes impatience because of that, that, you know, some, I don't want to say older people, but even my age and older, have for the modern stories where a hero story where there is no hero.
Right.
And, you know, so you get in The Boys, you get one universal theme, which is sin, essentially. Are there modern stories where you get sort of the universal theme of the outside hero, sort of the prince that comes in to save the day? And I think that's a harder one in a postmodern age to find, because postmodernism is more about deconstruction than...
Yeah, so the deconstruction is focused on your offenses against the law.
Yeah.
Right? I think what that leaves room for is a society wanting who's left empty. So my conclusion about The Boys in the paper was that it leaves you desperately empty.
It leaves you wanting one of those to actually be a hero.
Yep.
Yeah.
In reality.
Yeah.
I really liked that show. I watched that show, and by the end, I was waiting for one of the good guys to be good.
Yeah.
Right? Like, for there to be a change, and there never was. Like, you sort of got glimpses that maybe one of them was on their way to waking up and sort of being redeemed.
Yeah.
And they'd never allowed that redemption. But I don't think the thirst for redemption is bad when we actually have that. And it actually is part of the wake-up call that perhaps why there's a generation of people who can't write about redemption is because they have never experienced it.
Yeah.
Right? literature and the commentary of a society through literature often expresses what people have experienced and how they experience the world, how they imagine their place in the world, and it helps form other people's imaginations about where they are. And we can read that, watch that, witness that, and say that there's a whole generation or two of people who have not been redeemed, who have not experienced forgiveness.
Never even redemption. Seen it portrayed well.
Right. Yeah. So Mom and I are watching The Blacklist, as you know, because we run home every night and be like, got to binge some Blacklist. But it's James Spader, who's, I think he's probably 60 now, who stars in it. He plays sort of this, they call him the concierge of crime, right? He's this career criminal who's become an FBI informant, and he's giving them big cases that they didn't even know they needed, type thing. And in by all accounts, he's a bad guy. Like he kills people, sort of at times mercilessly. Oof. Again, lives by his own code, you know, and lives very stringently to his own code. But there's this interesting scene in there where the FBI assistant director who's in charge, his wife cheats on him. And the FBI assistant director moves out of the house. He's sleeping in his office and everything. And James Spader, who's the bad guy character, you know, it's always hard to tell whether he's good or bad, but let's just say he's a criminal, right? He comes in and they're meeting over a case, and he tells the assistant director guy that he needs to show a little bit of mercy and forgive his wife. And it's just this interesting sort of mix of forgiveness from somebody that you would otherwise, you know, or encouragement to forgive from somebody that you would otherwise think just didn't have forgiveness in them. That I think those kind of surprises, and even in literature, can make it so that if you don't have it in your everyday life, if you can see it on a screen or you can read it in a book, you can begin to recognize it if you see it elsewhere. And I'm kind of, you know, I want secular literature to be secular literature, but I think you sort of have the whole, you know, the themes of today's literature are very much deconstructionist.
Yeah.
And sort of just affirming the one universal, you know, that they have encountered, which is sin, judgment, and condemnation.
Yep.
And canceling.
Yep.
And I wish there was some really good stuff out there. I mean, I think the Mockingjay series.
The Hunger Games.
Hunger Games, which is good. You read them, I read them, I watched the movies, you watched the movies. There's no forgiveness there.
No, the end is uncharacteristically for a children's book or teen novel, bleak.
Yeah, it's bleak, yeah.
Yeah.
She decides to marry the person she does not love.
She regrets having children because the world's horrible.
Yeah.
And she lives depressed for the rest of her days. That's where you left.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, and I'm not one to, like, really praise the 20th century or even praise modernism all that much. But at the same time, you know, there were some idyllic themes in there that really were not only recognized by major characters, like, and Christian characters too, who themselves weren't necessarily, they weren't professors of Christianity as in their work, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Yep. They were essentially literature professors.
Yep.
C.S. Lewis, essentially classics, maybe we call it, it's called the greats. Oh,
absolutely.
Absolutely. But they were able to, in their time, recognize these themes, point them out, and then even write some of those themes of their own. Like in, you know, Lewis gets always hailed for the Chronicles of Narnia, but that's not it. I mean, you brought up The Great Divorce. A Dream About Heaven, essentially.
Yep.
Which is just, for people like me that struggle with the idea of heaven, you know, something like that is just...
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, what I tried to get at with both of these is that literature creates images that help us understand our world, but in so doing poses questions and answers to those questions, similarly to how you get the layout of, say, Luther's catechism with a, you know, a statement that leads to question that's given an answer. And I think one of the interplays is that a question that literature takes up about society, let's say especially about postmodernism, where you have all this deconstruction and no reconstruction, really, is it actually leaves space for Christianity to have an answer. So it says, what does this mean? But the author didn't write the answer. And so I think we're given this unique opportunity to speak, to write that answer, to give that answer that's been given to us about some of these things. Whereas, like, if you look at something like Lewis, both the question and the answer are there, and then can be that image that you're given to cling to, can then be given some doctrinal substance theologically, and these things can then work together. Part of this is like pragmatic in the course of memorization and learning. Image and story are very helpful. I used one of the works I referenced was Melanchthon gave a lecture on the use of fables.
Oh, did he?
And so that was, that's one of the few things that's translated in a couple of the volumes of Melanchthon. And he talks about how useful they are for teaching children things they cannot grasp yet. And that you can relay complex things to children through images, through things that they can grasp onto, and that this is formative because it helps you build categories for things in this world. For ethic, he talks about how it builds categories for ethics, builds categories about safety and danger. It builds categories, and it can build theological categories too. It can help with that, and then you have doctrine and preaching that comes in and actually gives you the written response or that thing that can be put to memory that corresponds to that image, to that thing that you're imagining. And this is similar in a way to like your being dad thesis, in there that those moments of grace that a child experiences from their father help them then when the doctrine of God is taught to them later, right? That you can actually understand that isn't, that it crosses the line where that's not just a dogma that you have to believe, right?
Right.
It's actually something you know.
Yeah.
You know something about.
It's just not words that are taught and memorized. It's something that you recognize.
But I think what one of the things that's important to clarify is that that gift part of that, say with the doctrine of God, that grace part of that, has to be delivered to you, has to be preached to you in the gospel, or else those images become a law. They become something you strive after, or you fail to do.
It's amazing in how many ways it can be done, too.
And you experience this when you go and teach being dad.
All the time.
Right?
I really had to change the way I taught it.
Yeah, you go preach this thing which you think... Yeah, is intended
is
to be
all,
this,
is
this,
all gospel
this image that helps people cling to the gospel or help fathers realize that their actions become an image of the, can become an image of the gospel to their children. And you end up with fathers sobbing because they believe that they have failed to be that image.
Yep.
Right.
Or they, I'll say this, some of them know it.
Right.
And they know it pretty plainly.
Right.
And, The interesting thing about that is that there's always a risk of committing one of the Lutheran cardinal sins, which is confusing law and gospel when you say something that I'm about to say. But it's very true that if you just walk into a room and start forgiving sins, some of the reactions, even though that's expressly gospel, right? Forgive your sins in the name of Jesus Christ. This is expressly gospel. Some of the reactions to that will be people drumming up their own sins and maybe being mad at you for thinking that you know their sins, that they need to be forgiven. And for the opposite.
Forgiving them when they have no...
I have no sins to forgive. What do you... You know, and this a similar thing happens when you teach being dad, is that the intent is to tell stories, to provide pictures of what good fathers are like, so that at the very least you might recognize if you've had that,
right?
Or you might recognize when you've been that, or you might find opportunities to be it in your vocation as father.
Right.
Now, I fully acknowledge that last one, that's, you know, to make some of our detractors happy. There's some third use of law category in that last one. But at the same time, it sort of proved the number of fathers who tell me that it was convicting for them to hear that proves the point that even the third use of the law always accuses, you know, and even when you don't intend it to, and even when I don't intend it to. And right. So, yeah. You know, it's interesting. Catechetically, stories and literature and pictures, they don't always do what you think they're going to do either.
Right.
And that's one of the, just one of the things you accept when you lean into this. And I think that's probably true for all the greats that have done this, right? Lewis relied on George MacDonald a lot. Lewis himself, Tolkien. There were other figures, Cormac McCarthy, and, you know, it's indispensable. The point that that Tolkien brings up in On Fairy Stories, where he sort of points out, though, that one of these universals that is in secular literature too, the sort of eucatastrophe, this yep. good catastrophe, that's one, you know, there are universals like that we recognize from scripture, like flood narratives, and
even to a more basic point, I would say the universals that we see are 99.9% of the time law. Right, yeah. They're like I said with the boys and right. and any of these postmodern ones, where if you find a use, it's going to be in the identification of sin and grievance. Even in things like C.S. Lewis and The Great Divorce, most of the image is actually going to be law, because it's about sort of the failure to progress from heaven to hell, and what that looks like. And it draws pictures about all the different people who stop along the way, who never yep. make it on the bus in the beginning.
Yep.
And you, from that first instance, you start asking questions. Am I in line, or am I
yep.
on the bus?
Yep.
Am I? And that is law until somebody tells you, yep. until a preacher breaks through and tells you yep. you're on the bus.
Yep.
You've been brought from hell to heaven.
Yep.
And you see that in the story. I would say the difference is you see that in the story too. As he's making his way, there are always external voices telling him where he is, where he's headed. Keep the eye locked on there. There's somebody breaking through. Mm-hmm. Because when it's about him, what he's doing, what he's choosing to do, there's no movement. And so that stays law, right? And so it's hard to, you know, without somebody breaking into your world, without somebody preaching to these categories, these images that you've created, they get left in law. It's sort of like it's like natural theology of all stripes. Without somebody, it's like Paul. Where did this get us?
Did you ever notice that the most glorious characters in The Great Divorce? Because essentially, what happens, right, is this guy who's on the bus, and a lot of people said it's Lewis's sort of purgatory, right?
Right.
But he gets off the bus and he's walking around this area, and he encounters things that become more and more real than he ever imagined could be real. But then he encounters people who are meeting other people who are on the bus, and the glorified people that they're meeting, you know, they knew in their life
real when
they're
still yeah.
alive. But that the most glorified people who are obviously coming down from heaven to meet these people, right?
This yep.
becomes sort of obvious. The most glorified people are just people who lived their vocations.
I never thought of it.
I mean, seriously, like the housewife who used to feed the young boy out of the back door kitchen, and
uh-huh.
I mean, they're just the most beautiful ones are the ones who just sort of lived their lives making other people happy, and it was never. They were never greatly accomplished people in the world. And this is often what the people around the bus point out to them. It's just, it's interesting. It's just, maybe that's one of the other themes. Sorry.
No, that's good.
A little off the reservation.
No.
No, it's and again, I would say is like too that that image has to have correspondence to a couple things, like you said, like vocation. Somebody you actually have to come in and give that theological significance, like vocation, because there is another way to take that. You can say, be like the woman who feeds children out of the beck, sacrifice for the poor, make it a law.
I think of this. It's like your grandmother or my grandmother, you know, making fresh bread.
Uh-huh.
And giving you a piece and making sure that every corner of the piece had butter on it.
Uh-huh.
You know, she's not doing anything that to the outward eye is spectacular.
Right. That's right.
But the way Lewis portrays it, that's the type of thing that was spectacular.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's...
You know? Yes.
But I guess my point and one of the things with the paper is that the image by itself is not enough. Right, like we use these images. We need these images. They help us cling to truths we know, but the image is not enough. That truth. This is why literature cannot just substitute theology. Right, that truth has to be proclaimed to you. You have to have been delivered the promise, delivered the beauty of that to recognize what the image really is. They can't just stand alone. And this ends up sort of being the difference between like a theologically informed work like Lewis's, like in the Chronicles of Narnia, like in The Great Divorce, where somebody who has been given that
Space Trilogy,
where somebody who's been given that promise is simultaneously in some aspects preaching the gospel and creating the image, right? And ones where just the image is created and somebody else has to come through and teach. And that this isn't just theology overbearing on literature.
So what, from your experience and your reading, do you have a piece of literature, non-Christian literature, that you think does this? That you think some of these themes are in, catechetical themes are in, besides The Boys? But like just a book, I'm thinking, like an actual piece of literature.
That does what in particular?
That has some of the catechetical themes can be recognized in and can be, you know, you could point to someday and saying, look here, it's here too.
Oh yeah. I mean, I honestly think you could pretty much do this with any piece of literature written. That's one of the funny things about it, right? Is that you can say that
the themes are so universal. It's present in most good literature.
And that you should ask people what they've read or what they think of when they think of something, because you know the access to literature is so broad that it could be anything. For me personally, I think there's loads of things I think of. The works of Homer, like the Iliad and the Odyssey, I think are kind of ripe with like classical images about life. I think there's been some better work done on this in recent years with Stanley Lombardo, who's done both translations of the Iliad and the Odyssey and even the Aeneid, and but then also done some lectures on things like the relation to men needing fathers or male figures, the wantingness of that, how soldiers with PTSD need these images to help cope with coming back from war, how something like the Odyssey is part of that tradition of giving people something they can cling to when they're no longer there, experiencing it. So where like the image helps you make sense of reality, that thing that you can imagine. And so then I think we can apply that to theology, where you need to have an image. And I think the parables are pretty clear. Melanchthon says this. He says in this thing on fables, he says, we know that this is one of the most holy ways to teach because our Lord constantly taught and he calls them in this instance, he says in fables.
Yeah. Well, hey. Yeah.
And
what's the difference between a parable and a fable?
And so he calls it essentially a divine form of teaching. Why? Well, God, you know, the kingdom of heaven is like, and now he gives you an image to think about.
One that you can, especially the people of his time, could conjure the image
right
pretty easily.
And most of them are, yeah, specifically contextual, right? You yeah. see wheat and chaff. You see a father who owns a, you know, basically a complex who has many servants and people working yeah, for him.
Sometimes when I teach on parables, I'll say that we think this is easy for us to understand, all these examples that Jesus gives.
It was even easier.
And if we think that, you know, we don't understand at all how much easier it would have been for the people of his time
right.
to understand these pictures. Because he's telling stories of his time. He's not telling stories yeah. of our time. Now, they can cross over, of course, but he's telling stories to the audience of his time that they can most easily understand.
Yeah. And I think, I forget which book it is, but I did a chapter on the parables where it talks about the, you know, the various parables where heaven is described as like a feast or a party.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you have this in the prodigal son at the end. There's a party, like the return is emphasized in a party. You have, like the wedding guests who reject God's invitation, and so yeah. He sends the servants out to go yeah. get
hither, thither, and yon.
Yeah, the yeah. poor, the decrepit, the sick.
Yep.
Right. And this is a party. This is a wedding feast. This is a banquet. And so we're given that image. Scripture, Christ Himself tells us that the kingdom of heaven is going to be like food and drink and a party where nobody there belongs there.
But they're all
and
there,
is given yeah. the best food and the best drink imaginable. And so you have that to think about when you think about heaven. And we know that people's images of things like heaven and hell are crafted by literature. A lot of the way most of us think about hell is likely influenced by Dante's Inferno.
Sure.
I mean, we think
I was thinking hell. On the other side of Babette's Feast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The way you think of heaven might be by imagery you've just seen of like angels painted through the Renaissance, the Middle Ages, and things like this. Great images where you kind of cling to that, and that's what you start to imagine, because there are parts of theology where the fullness of them have not yet been realized. We talk about this with like sanctification. You talked with Wesley about being 100% sanctified, or, you know, we are waiting for Christ's return. Well, because there's an aspect of our theology that's waiting, we have to fill those things that we're waiting for with something, and literature helps do that. But it's not always right. I guess that's one of the points is that there can be disagreements with literary image and what theological
sure,
truth
sure,
says. And that's sure. where that's where
even when it's right, it's a foggy picture. It's
right.
Not, it's
right. Not. And again, without somebody teaching or preaching it to you, those images more often than not are going to actually be kind of a law of something that you haven't fulfilled yet. An image that you need to go complete. And you actually have to have somebody come tell you that it's
been completed.
It's been completed, and now that image can change everything. And this is like Rod was saying, I think, last episode, where justification, when you see everything through the gospel, it's not just one thing that changes. It's everything that changes. And all of a sudden, all of those images change too.
Yeah.
And that happens at the preaching of the gospel. And so that's one of those areas where, like, I could say I had disagreements with something like the Seven Theses, which was trying to be done at a purely university level yeah. without a commitment to a particular religious tradition, right?
Yeah.
Is saying, well, I actually think Christianity offers something in this blank space.
Yeah. Real Christianity.
Too. Real Christianity. And yeah. where this is left. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Well, congratulations.
Yes, absolutely.
So
thanks for sharing with the listeners what you spent the last 3 years working on.
Did you get any help from anybody there?
Yeah. I got comments and feedback back.
Okay.
It's correspondence is interesting because it's sort of a part who you get and part how tenacious you are with trying to
sure.
say, hey, did you get that email? Hey, did you get that email?
Oh, gosh. And they're infamous for it, the British.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I would say it was probably good to be connected to a larger body of academics.
I would say if you're going to take on something that's like mostly research-based, I feel very blessed to be surrounded by people who can help me do that, who are just very close, right? Like, I don't have to go to school. I don't have to have a scheduled office hours with somebody always. I have a network of people who I can talk to you in the meantime while I'm waiting for maybe more formal interaction from the university or something like that.
Yeah, how many times did Adam read your thesis?
Twice, I think.
Yeah.
Which is good. And, yeah, I think, I mean, overall it went well. I learned some things. I would say in the thesis drafting process, it was not without its hiccups. I learned some things about organizing research. One of the challenges about going to the University of Nottingham, which is a challenge I wanted, is learning that there's an audience who doesn't have the same presuppositions about theology that you do, right? And doesn't, like one of the critiques at the end was still about, I had a lot of assumptions about what catechesis were that I didn't outline, or roadmap. And the reviewers wished I had spent more time doing, defining. I have just some, what that tells me is I just have some assumptions that even when I tried to explain what catechesis were, I didn't fully lay out. Because because I'm used to talking to other Lutherans who know exactly what I, what I mean when I say catechesis. So if I say catechetical use of literature to you guys didn't go, that sounds strange. But when I first wrote that and sent it for feedback, you know, the first piece of feedback I got was, can you very, very strictly define exactly what that means? I was kind of like, well, I think if you're Lutheran, this makes sense. Like, those words together just make sense. And I would send it to other Lutherans and be like, yeah, that makes sense. It's a good paper. And I'd send it to somebody who's like, could you define how one could catechize with literature? I'm like, well, I did a little bit, I thought. But
well, that's funny.
No, it ended up being good. And I did, I mean, in this episode, we only talked about it briefly, but I actually did, you know, like a third of the paper was engaging with some Melanchthon, which is what I really wanted to do.
Well, congratulations.
If I go on to doctoral
you got
work.
Me doing it.
Yeah, thank you. I would like to do specifically Melanchthon, and I think work on some of Melanchthon's use of literature. I think there's a lot to unpack there. And I dove just very briefly into it, mostly with sort of an exploration of how Melanchthon handled catechesis, and then his treatment of a brief treatment of fables and Homer, and then comparing. What I did is I saw how Melanchthon speaks about fables. I saw how Melanchthon talks about Homer. I translated the introduction to a catechism he wrote in 1558, and I saw the similarities, and I pointed out the similarities in how he treated literature and how he explained what catechesis was.
I didn't even get in seminary much of anything from Melanchthon other than what was in Bente, where he always wore a black hat. And that's why I went to attend Lowell Green's course. Yeah. I knew I didn't know.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, this is turning into a Melanchthon episode. Maybe I'll just cut it back a little bit. But, I mean, unfortunately, I think some of that narrative is turning back, but strangely positive. So, for people who are unfamiliar, the Bente narrative is that Melanchthon was sort of secretly a Calvinist who was...
Synergist.
Yeah, working against...
And a crypto-Calvinist.
Yeah, working against Luther to make Lutheranism more Calvinistic.
Initially to make it more synergistic, and then later, in sort of in the 40s, to make it more crypto-Calvinist regarding the supper.
I try to think black hat
all the way around.
But yeah, I try to think interim.
So now though, so
the pressure of the interim.
Now the point of that, the result of that was often to be wary of Melanchthon, sort of like as always a constant danger.
Oh yeah.
Now the narrative has turned to that same type of thing, except to say that less that he was a crypto-Calvinist and more that his views are actually more representative of the Lutheran views, and Luther is sort of actually against the Lutherans on these issues. And so we've returned to the Bente. We've returned to the Bente narrative just with the different ends. And so...
Yeah. Well, I summarize that by saying I didn't know anything about Melanchthon from my seminary training.
Yeah.
I sat in the same classes with other guys where our textbook was Bente.
Yeah, but, yeah, I think there's loads to... I mean, my dad's obviously done some continued work. I think there's loads to unpack with Melanchthon still. And I, you know, just from the people who, you know, heavily do interact with Luther and Melanchthon, the relationship between them, the relationship between their doctrine. I don't think this Luther and Melanchthon, you know, secretly working against each other thing holds up.
There's so many stuff. If you imagine, if you imagine a chemist's balance pan, there's so much on the side of Luther praising Melanchthon for what he did.
Oh, it's hard to reconcile.
It's just, you know, why we have to. These are two men who worked together at the same university for, you know, Luther dies in 1546. Melanchthon gets there in 1819. Right, so they worked together in the same university for a quarter of a century, and they were friends and colleagues.
Yep.
And co-confessional, you know.
Yes.
And you know, to say that they were, one was secretly working against each other,
the burden of proofs other, on that guy.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the reality is that if you take, if you put the we got on Reformation, that's hilarious.
We're so far.
If you put the Reformation starting in 1517, right, and I don't know how, where do you want to take it? You want to take it to the Formula of Concord, so 1580, right? In that sort of 65-year time period, you want to call that the Reformation. Luther is only alive for 26 years of that, right? And then he dies. And then you have another 35 years plus of Reformation where people are working off the memory of what he said.
Yep.
And it's not fair to say that somebody who was his colleague for that entire time he was alive is working against him when circumstances change dramatically after his death. And it's just not honest. It's trying to find malice where
I agree.
Malice probably didn't exist.
And the opposite existed.
Yeah, and if you go to find malice, I'm sure, you know, via confirmation bias and other things, I'm sure you can find some lines out of some letters that might lead you to believe that it existed. But you try to be friends with somebody for 26 years and never get mad at them.
Yeah.
Yeah,
good illustration.
And I think a lot of this is, you know, is you're constantly wary of arguments from influence as well, not just like that he disliked Luther or something secret like that, but just that there's like an influence argument about where true Lutheranism actually ends up or whatever.
Yeah, so
this episode's now off the rails.
Yeah, well, I've told the story that I, when I first sat down with Jim to discuss what I wanted to do, I wanted to talk about Melanchthon's influence on X, Y, or Z, and he said, first of all, never do an argument from influence because it's impossible to prove, mm-hmm. unless somebody strictly states it.
Yep.
Yeah.
You're working on conjecture.
Yep.
And that's not what we do.
Mm-hmm.
We don't work on conjecture. We try to accurately report and analyze what people actually said.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Know what we think they meant.
So with that, I, you know, hope to, and I think 1517, I know there are plans in the work to continue looking at what Melanchthon actually said, and I hope to be a part of that too. And so I think that's a good place to end with this episode. The Thinking Fellows has done loads of episodes on Melanchthon, so if, you know, you're a relatively new listener, you don't remember those episodes, and it's making you think about that. If you just search Melanchthon on iTunes or on Thinking Fellows, you'll find a lot of episodes.
We have to have the most episodes on Melanchthon on iTunes. Probably. We have to.
probably do. Yeah. And and look forward to 1517 continuing to work on future projects dealing with Melanchthon.
All right.
All right. We'll catch you next time. Bye.